Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June 29th, 2001. In the Creekside room this morning is John Marty. Today's session is From New Deal to Raw Deal. Let's listen in.
For security in your old age, for disability, you get disabled, you can't work, we take care of that. It was a time where unemployment compensation, you get laid off from your job, we're going to help you bridge the gap until you find new work. Certainly economic security for the poor stepped in then with what later became AFDC and in our concept of, in the 60s, food stamps and other things added to it, but it was basically the first time government says, we are going to try and do something for those who fall through the cracks, the social safety net. Certainly there was, whether you would call it government is a last employer of last resort or first resort or whatever, at a time of high unemployment, the WPA, the Civilian Conservation Corps, the sort of alphabet soup of programs from the New Deal, I still see people who tend to be in their 80s, upper 80s now, who, I helped build that bridge for Minnesota, some of the state parks. You can see the stone bridges and the walkways and everything else that were put together by people as part of the Civilian Conservation Corps. You see the little plaque or WPA, and again, most of the people who were involved in that are now in their 90s or upper 80s, but you still see people who talk with pride about, I helped build that. And very tough manual labor. I keep wondering how they built these. Way out here, we came past Cooley Dam, and building all these things with much more manual labor. But government stepped in and was, I think you'd call it the employer of last resort, but in many cases it was the only resort they had. So government stepped in there, and also at the same time, not just the economic programs they had, the employment programs, the economic security, the social security, and so on. But there also was this time where it was a sort of decision, we're going to give workers certain rights. Instead of 60 hours a week of work or whatever, it was moved to 44, and then 40 hours was full-time work. You get paid extra if you're over 40 hours a week. A minimum wage is put in place with the concept that you're not going to be rich if you're working, but just because you work doesn't mean you're not entitled to wealth, but at least you're going to get a minimum that will be able to meet your basic necessities, your food, shelter, basic needs. And they put these things into place as part of the New Deal, and then later on, what you might call the legacy of the New Deal, building into the 60s even, the GI Bill, educational opportunity. We not only have the sense that we're going to help you economically when you lose your job or something, but we're going to help you in order to be able to get better jobs. We're going to give educational opportunity. The GI Bill is part of that. The affordable housing programs, and then in the 60s, the Medicaid and Medicare, where if you're poor, we're going to make sure you can have some sort of affordable health care. If you're a senior citizen, we're going to make sure you have affordable health care. And those things, phenomenally wide, incredibly widespread. In Minnesota today, I think about 80% of our nursing home residents are Medicaid recipients. Very few people can afford, or vast majority of people cannot afford, years in a nursing home on their own retirement, just because of the high cost of it. And 80% of those in nursing homes are, in Minnesota, Medicaid recipients. The state is paying the tab because they have spent down their entire savings. A lot of this was very expensive stuff. Some of it was done by, in the 30s was the first time the country started building a debt, though even after we left the New Deal legacy, the debt kept going, kept growing. But it was mainly funded through progressive tax policies, especially at the federal level where most of the costs of these things were paid. They were paid for by a steeply, at the time, progressive income tax. And I guess I'd summarize this whole New Deal concept as the progressive tax policy, namely the more you make, the higher percentage of your income you pay. The less you make, the lower percentage you pay. And at the same time, investment in people, making sure they have economic security, making sure they have that investment in communities, again, to the point of, I mean, the WPA and so on weren't just to provide jobs, they were also to build infrastructure. Investment in the interstate highway system in the 50s. We invested in communities. We even invested in rebuilding Europe after the war with the Marshall Plan. So it was a big sense of investing in people, investing in communities, and building a safety net. You're down and out. We're going to try and step in there and help meet the needs. In contrast, the reversal of direction, which I would say the 70s might have been sort of a transition decade, but since the 1980s, there's been basically a reversal of all these things, the progressive tax policies, the investment in people, and the social safety net. This reversal, which, I don't know, I called it for the title's talk, Raw Deal, call it a big deal, whatever deal you want to call it, it's been a big change that I would say was initially fueled, at least in part, by resentment of government. The stories of welfare cheats, not just welfare cheats, but lazy people. They're getting our money, they're doing nothing for it, and of course I worked hard for my money. They are getting something at that. I was going door to door, which I do in my legislative district from time to time. A couple years ago, I do it in non-election years too. It's a good way to hear what's on people's minds. And in a subsidized housing development, it's for low-income folks. I went to some door and some guy was saying, oh, how angry he was at welfare cheats and welfare recipients and how lazy they were and so on and so on. And I was thinking, oh, this guy's living in subsidized housing. What's he complaining? Oh, these welfare moms and all their kids and doing this and doing that. And then I started just sort of gently asking him. I wasn't going to argue with him or anything, but I asked him about, I may have asked him about food stamps. Yeah, he got them, but yeah, it's a good thing. And I asked him about two or three different things. The subsidized housing, obviously, that was a good thing. I mean, he was living in subsidized housing. And yeah, for people who need a helping hand while they're down and out, those were all good. But he really resented these welfare cheats. And I was going to say that even he himself, as a welfare recipient, not AFDC, I don't know that he had kids, but he was still receiving welfare benefits. But it's those other welfare people who are the ones that I really resent. And there's that sort of welfare cheats was part of this fueling of the new political change. Those welfare cheats are people who are taking advantage of me. Plus, there's the bureaucracy. Everybody hates a bureaucrat. What's a bureaucrat? Well, our neighbor who happens to work in state transportation department or somewhere, well, he works hard, he's a decent guy, but boy, there are too many people shuffling papers and so on. Schools, yeah, I'm frustrated at times that seem to get more and more school administrators. School districts keep pointing out that every time since we've come here, the federal government passed more testing requirements and more paperwork, and the state passes more paperwork on. So I understand. I mean, a lot of teachers I talk to are resentful of it. The public at large is going to be resentful of the fact that there's a lot of bureaucracy. Last private sector job I worked in, I was going to say awfully backwards bureaucracy there too, but it's something that people can resent. They can put their finger on my dollars, I worked hard to get them, and that's going to this cause. And the final thing I'd say that fueled the initial change in the politics is the sense that special interests are running the way things work. Why in the world do we pay $600 for a toilet seat for military? Just somebody's ripping off the system, and special interests have way too much clout. And that fueled a lot of the change in policy, which is almost ironic because in many ways special interest groups have a lot more clout now than ever, and a lot of the direction in which the change in the politics has been, I would argue, has been fueled by special interest doing it. So initially the movement was funded by some of the resentment of government, which hasn't gone away, but it's not the main driving force. In later years, I would say since the early 90s, it's been fueled largely by the booming economy and the ability to have more government. Instead of the deficits of the 80s, we've got surpluses from the 90s on, and the booming economy. Of course, Bill Clinton claims credit for his policies doing this. Republicans claim credit for it from the Contract for America. Everybody in politics, oh, times are good. We did it. And not only between the two parties in Washington, you have the same thing, especially when there's a Democratic president and a Republican governor, or Democratic governor and Republican president. In the good times, we did it. Here in Minnesota, our legislature and our governor, we're the ones who are generating the great economy. We're the ones who are providing this. And Washington, they claim the same things. Of course, when the economy turns sour, it goes the other way around. If only those people in Washington would be doing the right thing, our economy would be doing better. Don't blame us at the state. The same thing at the federal level, they blame it there. So there's a lot of blame shifting. I would argue that in addition to government policies, which do have an impact on the economy, but the biggest single reason for the booming economy that I'd argue is food fueling the change in government, is we've had incredible technology revolution, something that may not be at an end. I mean, I think technologies are going to come. Is technology going to change our life as much in the next 20 years as it has in the past 20? I remember in the early 80s, not long after I got out of college, reading an address from former president of either Princeton or Lawrence University, I can't remember which, he wrote about how the class of 1958, I guess it was the Princeton class of 1958, well over a third of the graduates 25 years later were working in fields that did not exist at the time they graduated. Wow, that was phenomenal. Well, how many people who graduated in 1983 from Princeton are working in fields that did not exist at the time? Probably even a higher percentage. It really has changed things, and when $1 can buy you 10,000 times as much computing power as it could have then, we've had incredible, I'd argue, that may be the biggest single factor we've had in the booming economy over the last decade, though both state and federal Republicans and Democrats all claim credit for it. It's doing very well. And as a result, in addition to the resentment of government, the economy's provided one more revenue for government. The faster the economy grows, the more people pay in taxes because their incomes are higher, or sales taxes, they buy more, or property taxes, their property is worth more. So government revenue goes up as the economy goes up, and at the same time, there's less need for the government services. You don't need to pay for as much subsidies for housing or other things if there aren't as many people unemployed. You don't have to pay unemployment compensation and other things to people who are down and out, food stamps, if they're working than if they're unemployed and struggling. So the combination of more government revenue, less need for government services is reversed the trend of government having growing deficits. It's caused surpluses. Minnesota, I think we've had 4 years in a row now where the economy has grown each time faster than the projections. Since we try and have forecasting based on a middle range projection, if it grows fast, you got more money than you thought you'd have. So taxes get cut and whatever happens, and then next time, oh, it's better yet, so we keep a shifting target, and that looks very good and is very positive. But what has happened, what has government done with this booming economy, and what's the change of direction resulted in? One the biggest change in the revenue side of the equation is the tax code has become much more regressive. And the biggest single cause of this is federal government pushing responsibility to states. Housing federal government back heavily out of, and federal government tax code was fairly progressive. States, Minnesota is one of the most progressive, meaning it's only slightly regressive, meaning that if you're high income, you pay a lower percentage of your income, more in total dollars, but lower percentage of your income than people who are middle class, and they pay a lower percentage than people who are low income. And Minnesota is far more progressive than most states. We get a third of our income or so from a progressive income tax with brackets that were about 6, 8, and 8.5%. So the more you make, you pay a slightly higher amount more, but that's canceled by a lot of business taxes, property taxes, sales taxes that are regressive. So the shift to the states has resulted in more regressive taxes. And on top of that, whenever there's a need to cut taxes, the taxes that get cut tend to be the most progressive taxes. We cut the income taxes mainly. And when you raise taxes, you do it by regressive tax. How has this happened? Well, the heavy push from those who would benefit most by cuts in the progressive taxes, higher income folks have pushed heavily for that, and there's been they've sort of used the whole argument that taxes are too high and government's wasting money, the bureaucrats and the welfare cheats and everything else. We got to cut taxes, and they don't say what we're cutting, and then in the end, the states and federal government cut taxes in a way that largely ends up being regressive. 2 years ago, Minnesota's largest tax cut in our state history was sold by all three parties. Their governor is a third party. Was sold by all three parties as heavily tilted towards benefiting the middle class. In fact, over half the benefit went to the top 15%. The middle 50% got less than a third of it. So it's sold as being proportional, at least, when in fact they are regressive in terms of the cuts. Far more than the taxes were progressive to start with, because they weren't. When those taxes are increased, and again, I gave a talk on this last week, when we talked about corporate subsidies, stadiums, which again, some of the higher income folks, Minnesota has maybe 7, 8, 10 billionaires, and about three of them own major league sports franchises, and they're all asking for government subsidies. When they ask for this, they don't ask for income tax increases to pay for them. They use sales taxes, excise taxes, the regressive types of taxes, and they sell it as, well, this is a matter of choice. You don't have to buy, you have to buy products that you do this with. It's minimal cost, and there's a public benefit. So in effect, both the state, the shift to the states and the state revenue sources have been becoming much more regressive. Then the other part of it is we've had the other half of this new political movement has been a cut in investments. We've cut way back on education investments as a percentage of our spendable money as an economy. We don't spend as much on education, higher education or K-12 than we used to, unless you factor in all the things we never, 30 years ago, you didn't have to provide special education. Very costly, but we require the schools to do more. The cost that we're providing per student hasn't kept up with, if you take the education portion of it, not the social services, the school breakfasts, the other things, but just the education portion, we've been slipping. Higher education institutions, we don't provide nearly as much government research funding for that as we used to. We've cut back. So education, the infrastructure. Minnesota, I'll use as an example, our roads, we're replacing one every, we're repairing and rebuilding one, about 1% a year. That, I mean, roads don't last 100 years. So they are, it is a slowly crumbling infrastructure, and we don't invest in prevention. So we've cut back on investments, we've changed our tax policy, we've cut the safety net significantly. I mentioned earlier federal housing. Welfare, as we've called it, of the AFDC thing and so on, put time limits on it. Nursing home funding has gone way back. Medicare benefits, what Medicare covers, it was supposed to be the seniors' plan for health care, but you have Medicare supplement policies, which are becoming unaffordable for many people. We've slowly been slipping back in some of those safety net things. And then I would argue we've backtracked on a lot of public consumer worker protections, the bankruptcy reform in recent years, making it much harder to declare bankruptcy, workers' comp reform in Minnesota, and I think a lot of other states have made it where I know lots of workers who have been injured and cannot work, and in the end, some of them collect welfare. They go into poverty because those with some very serious long-term injuries because of our workers' comp changes. Then we've weakened other things. Minimum wage laws have not kept up. You work full-time at a minimum wage, you're not close to being able to pay your bills. The compact that we had with people, you work full-time, you can afford to pay for necessities, that's changed in the last, it may never have been fully there, but Minnesota, half the people in our homeless shelters are working people. Or their families. And we didn't have that 30 years ago, but we do have working people in shelters and so on. What's the impact of this shift? Well, of this recent last 20 years of politics, for a significant, not a major percentage, but a significant number of people, it's been what we would have called in earlier years untold wealth. The three-car garage, with things for each shed in the garage. I mean, this SUV and minivan and other things. Homes far bigger than our parents would have had for a bigger family. Significant number of people who done well. I mean, many young dot-com multimillionaires, they're convinced they worked very hard. They're convinced they did everything on their own. It's their money and so on. The vast majority of people are doing quite well. Times have never been better. The economy is doing well and people are doing well. The fact that spending on consumer goods, on vacations, why are the airlines so busy? More people are able to travel. Most people are doing better than they've ever done. And that accounts for, as I said, most people, there is still, despite the booming economy, depends how you calculate, maybe 1 in 8 people who are struggling. They're left out of it. And many of them, like the wealthy, like the extremely quick gains in wealth, many of them are extremely hardworking, working 2 jobs. Many of them aren't. So some of the people who may have struck it rich quickly may not have worked quite as hard as some others either. There are many people who are working very hard and not doing quite well. You also have those who, because of disabilities or other things, may not be people who were institutionalized 30 years ago, who, because mental illness or some sort of disability, are not functioning well and they're struggling to get by. I hear from time to time about the people who child care is too costly, so their kids are certainly latchkey kids. They go home from school totally unsupervised. This isn't just 12, 13-year-olds. This is 5, 6-year-olds. They go home and there's nobody at home. The homeless, I've met families who work and sleep in cars for months at a time. In Minnesota, they tend to bounce from homeless shelter to point. More and more people without health care coverage, you don't go to the doctor until it's desperate, and usually the system will end up paying for it in a very poor way, the emergency room, the very costly way. Kids, I mean, my wife works at a school and she sees kids who stay home from school, they're sick the day of a field trip because it's a $2 fee or so. And in Minnesota this year, it looks like most schools are raising sports fees from for a kid in middle school, high school to participate in a sports program, they go from $75. Some of them are going to be over $200. There are a lot of kids who, I guess I'm not that interested in going out for this. I don't think I will this year. They're not going to tell you I don't have the money. But realistically, that happens. So there is, again, while the economy's been very good for most of us and a few people incredibly good, there are also a lot of people who aren't pulling it and who aren't able to make it, who are suffering, and the safety nets kind of collapsing around them, and their jobs aren't paying enough. And I would suggest that the other day in Bible study they were talking about Jacob and Leah and Joseph, and I was sort of reading ahead in Genesis after that a little bit, and came across the Genesis account of Joseph reading Pharaoh's dreams about 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. And because they had the foresight from the dream to read ahead to when it was going to come, what did they do? They did wise things. They stored up grain and they built barns for it and they worked hard to prepare for it. When the bad times came, they were prepared for it. Unlike the Genesis account, we're not replenishing our storerooms. We're consuming it. We're consuming oil and petroleum products faster than ever. We're consuming our natural resources faster than ever. And we're not banking anything. We used to have the petroleum oil reserve, which was put in place partly because of OPEC and the realization that, you know, we could be sunk as a nation. Strategically, we need petroleum products for our military, if nothing else. And certainly we need it for a lot of other things. We don't generate enough stuff. Well, our petroleum reserve, well, to bring down prices, if price spikes, we've sold off a lot of that. And we consume, each family, each person consumes far more petroleum than we did at the time of the energy crisis from OPEC in the early 70s. And not only do we consume more, but we're totally oblivious to it. We're more dependent on foreign oil than we were then. We've got a lot more domestic production, but we get a higher percentage and we need more from other countries to sustain ourselves. In addition, unlike the Pharaoh storing up in the 7 good years, we're actually adding to the burdens of the next generation. The public infrastructure that I suggested earlier, we're not keeping up on environmental cleanup. Last week, the speaker from Hanford Nuclear Waste Dump here talking about what we have to do to clean up our past mess. His estimate was $40 billion over the next 40 years to do it. That's if we do the plan that they've got in place. It'll take 40 years and $40 billion. They need $400 million now to keep their contracts to start the process going. They got $65 million for it. Whose problem is that? It's the next generation. They're going to have to clean it up and have to clean up perhaps more because it's leaking. We're shifting burdens to the next generation, and I think one concrete example that I've seen in our state legislature is 2 years ago, the first of 3 annual rebates we've given now because of tax surplus, we actually borrowed money to increase the size of the rebate. Who pays for the borrowed money? Well, the same people get the rebates eventually, only they pay it with principal and interest. So the state, by borrowing, we shift the cost to the next 30 years down the road, and we increase the size of the rebate. So unlike ancient Egyptians, where according to Genesis, they stored up in the good years, we're not only not storing up, but we're actually borrowing from the future in many ways. And the federal government is not increasing the size of the deficit. They're actually, for the last couple of years and the next couple of years, we're at least slowly paying it down. But Medicare and Social Security, are we saving up enough for that because of the dynamics of the age growth and population? We don't have the warnings of Pharaoh's dreams. I don't know. I can't say that we're in the midst of good times, and we're not going to be in the midst of good times 5 years from now. And given the fact that nobody could have projected that the economy, nobody did project, that the economy was going to do so well, and all the forecasts from the economists kept saying, well, it's going to go up a little bit, but then it's going to dip, and it hasn't. It's been, the growth has slowed significantly, but it hasn't been into a real recession for a long time, and saying that we're going to have a recession and predicting dire things, I don't think we can do. But I can tell you that I wouldn't want to bank on the other one either, that we're going to continue because of new technology or whatever to have continuing growth in the economy and so on. And what does happen? Will the bad years come? We don't know. When will they come? How bad will they be? I don't know. But if it does happen, what about those who are homeless now, who are working and don't have it? What about those with the developmental disabilities who maybe can get a minimum wage job? And certainly, they can get on a waiting list for housing and programs to help them participate in society. I know a whole lot of people like that who are living at home with their aging parents, their 75-year-old parents, and what do we do with our child when we die? There's no place to send them. What about those who teens who become pregnant now? There's little gaps. What about the seniors who choose now between food and heat because they don't have the savings, they don't have the Social Security, they don't have what they need to pay all their bills? What do we do with them when the time comes up? I'm ending this with a lot of questions because I don't think we know. Will we have another political earthquake? People saying, you know, we've got untold wealth, and one of my talks, maybe it was this week or last week, I talked about how much wealth do we have. I saw in the airline flight magazines where you find all these amazing little trinkets. Briefcase, $1,200 briefcase, all it had was a little model train in it, electric, the real tiny one. Very clever little train, but $1,200 for something you set on your lap and watch this train go around. There's some adults who, obviously, if they're selling it, somebody's buying it. At times like that, when other people work two jobs and can't pay the bills, I think there is a chance that there will be a major political shift at such time as we have growing disparities, but I don't know. I mean, I think all of this is a lot of ifs. What if? I, for one, would feel a lot better if we took some hints from the ancient Egyptians and decided maybe we ought to look ahead and have the foresight to do some of the rebuilding of infrastructure now, of taking care of our messes from environmental harm, spills, and so on now. And if we do some of the investing in prevention, the healthcare prevention efforts, the chemical dependency, trying to get beyond those problems now because they do cost more if we don't address them. But I wanted to spell this out as a kind of a sense of what's been happening in the past 70 years in American politics, maybe 30 years one way, then 10, 15 years of sort of slow transition, and now the last 20 years of a different direction. And kind of want to see if people, how you read that. If you're seeing the same thing, if you think that's wrong, I welcome challenging that and whatever. But I think we've moved from a situation where government at one point said, we're going to have this compact with the public. Compact, I still would argue, is very popular. If you poll people, do you think every person or every working person should have affordable health care? I think 80% in the numbers I've seen say yes. Do you think that people who are working full-time should be able to afford to pay the bills? I think they'd say yes, overwhelmingly. So it's a popular compact that was started in the New Deal, never fully fulfilled, lots of mistakes made throughout the course of it, but now we've changed to a direction where it's not the role of government, government's not going to do that, or we talk about doing it, and it's priorities have shifted. And so with that, I guess I'd like to open it up for discussion or whatever about it. Questions as well.
Just to comment that Seems to me that what we've done is made government into an entity someplace and lost that sense of community. And I don't hear the language of community anymore, that somehow we all belong together in this thing.
Everyone for himself, kind of, I mean, it's...
The government will do it.
Yeah.
And it's an entity, I think is what you're saying. And it's not a person anymore. It's this entity and institution that they'll take care of. I mean, I've heard people say, well, you know, the government should teach me how to parent my child because I don't know. And there's a lack, I think that there's a relinquishing of personal responsibility towards the government, and the institution cannot, it's an institution, it's not a person, it can't hold that responsibility, it can't execute that responsibility, especially not in a way that embodies grace.
I was going to say, I'm hearing two slightly different angles on this, or significantly different, I don't know, but I don't hear what you're hearing about people saying, oh, I don't want to do this, government will take care of it. I guess I don't hear that from people as one who supports like early childhood programs.
I don't hear it nearly as much as I used to.
Okay. There, that may be that it was there at one point. I was going to say, I think there's some people, some of the resentment about welfare recipients who weren't working and so on was because some of the programs were designed in such a way that didn't put responsibility on somebody. I was going to say, when the thing I don't know if you were saying what I was hearing about early childhood things, I don't want government to be doing people's parenting for them, but I also recognize and strongly believe that early childhood programs make good sense.
Yes.
We ought to be doing it. We ought to be making sure parents do a good job, but the fact is, frankly, not just low-income parents, but I think we can all benefit from some things like that. And I was going to say, I think a lot of that makes good sense to do, and we ought to be doing it. I don't hear now, at least, and I think you're saying that too, that people are saying government will do it. And the trick always becomes, how do you get people to have the responsibility? I think it's important. Work is very important for people, not just for income, but because when we introduce ourselves, maybe at Holden, it's who are you, how long are you here, and where are you from? But everywhere else in the world, your name, and then what do you do? It's part of our identity and our sense of contribution to society. And I think one of the problems of the New Deal safety net was that it didn't do that well. And now kind of it gets to the point where instead of fixing the safety net in a logical way, it's kind of like we'll give you a little helping hand to get work, but beyond that you're on your own, and if the work doesn't pay enough to pay for the child care, for the health care, and so on, you're out on your own. And I've always felt the best way to do it is make sure people are required to take responsibility for things, but make sure when they do it that they can succeed at doing it.
Yeah.
I don't think we've moved that way. It's kind of, we moved away from institutionalization of people with disabilities, which was a good move, but what did we replace it with? Well, some thoughts that we never implemented.
Does wealth, like prosperity in a nation or a state, kind of assist in destroying community?
I wonder if Judy's comment on that too could, the Roman civilization, did it fail because it didn't do things right, or did it do it because people got too comfortable? Too much of a sense of I'm this is the way it's always going to be. Things are better and I'm doing well. And I don't know. Are we too comfortable? And certainly at this time in the economy, we don't have to worry about, we should be worrying about a whole lot of, you know, trying to act about certain things. But instead, you know, it's easier than worrying about those things. We push them out of our mind and we just continue consuming more, not addressing our problems because it's not comfortable to talk about. I don't know.
When we have, when everyone is struggling and is poor and is just trying to get by, it seems like it's very easy to form community and share resources and share loads and share effort. And as soon as it begins to work and you become more affluent, everybody feels like, well, I did this on my own. And then the community issues, well, you know, you work harder. I managed to make it, you know, you can do it if you work hard. But no community support to help them. And that's the way our government has become. We've sort of said, well, we're economically secure because we worked hard and the businesses are doing well and so forth. And those of you that aren't reaping the benefit just haven't worked hard enough. Not realizing that the community
The common good, the community, I was going to say when you asked where'd that go, it may be, as you said, when times are tough, we all have to pull together. I mean, we were in the middle of a depression at the time World War II came about, and there was never a more clear to the American public what that everything they value is at great risk, and freedom for the world against fascism was a great threat. We're being attacked. We have to do something. What do? We pulled out of this deepest economy ever and built an incredible, in no time, started building a war machine that beat two superpowers, and people sacrificed, I mean, scrap metal, recycling, everything else, rationing. We went to great extremes as a community to do it because we had a cause we had to do. We had to pull out of our difficulties. And now, as you said, you know, people who do that, people who benefited from the GI Bill, from this, rose up there. Now, I did this all on my own. Why can't you guys? Mm-hmm. Our governor seems to embody that to me. I mean, a few years ago, the head of our state chamber of commerce, or what became the chamber of commerce, was a guy who had a thing, he was leading a no taxes campaign, and I thought he was talking about how we put too much into public things, into schools and other things. I thought, this guy, public school student, University of Minnesota student, University of Minnesota law student, publicly subsidized education every step of the way, and now, well, we don't need that anymore. I think a lot of it was we sense we did it ourselves. And your point.
I think that the common struggle or a common need
challenge
is it's. I just finished this past Sunday the Washington D.C. AIDS ride from Raleigh Durham to D.C. on a bicycle. Well, it was amazing to see at the campsites every night people helping each other set up tents, mm-hmm. people cooperating, people helping each other along the road if they had a flat tire. Mm-hmm. We got into D.C., and in addition to the fact that the cell phones were flying out of the bags at that point, but I mean, that was fine because people were calling their family so they could meet them, but and that was not a strong community, and it was very much a secular community, but still, the way the community crumbled as soon as people had comfort, and as soon as people had image to maintain and things like that, it just went apart. And, I mean, the last couple miles, there was no, people were not thinking about making sure that somebody had a flat tire, got the tire fixed, or things like that. It was just
on what they do next.
It was the common effort of, yeah, the 300 miles behind us, we're done.
There was no common struggle.
Mm-hmm. And I have a life,
I'm going to take care of my life.
And it, I think what's sad is that there has to be, in some ways it's sad, in some ways it's good. But the fact that we have to, the sad part is it has to be a common struggle that really embodies pain, mm-hmm. rather than it can just be something which is a sense of something bigger than ourselves that even though we are comfortable, we can somehow commit to. And I think the one other thing that I would add is, and this is one of the problems that is in our current economy and also in our current legislative systems, is if you go in the shower, and the best analogy is, the term is dynamics, but the best way to term it is, if you go in the shower in the morning, you turn it on, it's cold. You have to wait for that hot water to make it warm the pipe. But if we make a change in the system, whatever the system is, and we don't wait for it to go through the system, we have no idea what the full impact of it is. So if you say, well, it's not hot enough, and you keep cranking, at some point you can burn yourself. And you get, then you spin it the other way. So if you've cranked on the system so hard to get it to the point where you burn yourself, then you crank the other way, well, you can't know.
You're panicking.
Your system is doing this. Uh-huh. And what's our stock market doing right now? Mm-hmm. And part of it is because I think we are over operating or over cranking on the system. And I don't say we shouldn't. I mean, I think some of the stuff we've pulled out is ridiculous to have pulled out. But at the same time, some of the changes that we need to make very slowly. So that we don't, and that's one of the reasons we have the stronger economy is Greenspan tends to keep his hands off. He lets things go slowly, and that's one of the biggest things that the stability that's come from that has probably than anyone really wants to admit. And you know, both parties claiming, oh, well, we did this.
Which is going to continue happening no matter what happens.
The response to that is one word, it's not polite. Because some of the changes that were made were an impact of 20 years ago, some were 5 years ago, some were 10 years ago. And, you know, everybody...
And they'll continue to claim the credit is...
Right.
Even though their policies may have very small impact on it.
Yes.
I wanted to get back, I think it's a good point about the waiting and making sure we do things instead of the up and down thing. But your earlier point, which I think tied in with the previous comment about how when there's a common cause, a common challenge, a common whatever, suffering, we tend to pull together as a community and work together. I don't know who said it, the church's role is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. I almost wonder if there's a way that, you know, and rather than saying, because I don't think it's a humane thing to do or anything else, to say, well, you know, when times get really bad, then we'll have another pendulum swing and we'll go the other way again. But why, I mean, is there a way the church, I mean, when they say the church is to challenge us, and some of the Old Testament prophets challenging us, did the Vespers a week ago, Thursday, and quoting Amos, and very harsh words. But taking those of it, he called you cows of Bashan. I mean, calling people cows because of the way they're living too comfortably while others are hurting and so on. Is there a way that we can move so we don't have these crises before we pull together and recognize now these are the good times? And can't we pull together as a common thing and address the many things that are left out in the current things and do it so that when the bad years do come, we prevent it? Mm-hmm. You had a comment back there a while ago.
Well, this morning I was at Bible study and there was a comment that everything we own we either protect or maintain. Talk about our stuff. And I think a lot of the sense of lack of community is because of that.
And part of it's comfort, but part of it is just marketing, and that we've gotten used to having an awful lot of stuff that requires so much energy to keep going that we don't have the energy left for the relationships or the advocacy or looking outside of ourselves. So I almost think the job of the church these days is to really help people focus on core values. And that, in a way, frees us up to be able to do some of these things. Because, I mean, the government, yeah, we talk about it as separate, but it's just like the church. The church isn't out there, the church is us. The government isn't out there, the government is us.
But also, nice point, go ahead.
Yeah, also, the church, though, also gives a double message, or it seems to me that we spend a lot of time on self-actualization, self-realization, and self-improvement, and individual spirituality, and where is our community actualization and community spirituality?
Look at church benevolence and how much of our mission stuff is focused on us.
I
mean, our church's theme, hospitality, we want to be a hospitable congregation. That means how much more comfortable can we be, it almost seems to me, than how can we address these, but yeah.
Just kind of piggybacking on that, I think that in order to really meet the needs of as many people as need in the world, one has to sacrifice some freedom. Give something
else. You're saying the concept of the common good versus the individual.
Yeah, and that's just a glaring contrast. And it's very difficult to work against because we really do believe in the individual.
Yeah. And the comment over a minute ago about the advertising, where we're convinced we need, these are our needs now, and expectations that, I mean, how many ads sort of hint, you deserve this pamper yourself kind of thing. You deserve the new Lexus because of whatever. I still think that part of our role as a church has to be looking at the whole concept of stewardship. When we talk about private property and so on, what I own isn't going to be mine 150 years from now. It just isn't. I'm not going to be here. And if I decide that if I can buy 40 acres of land and do whatever I want to do with them, and it's nobody else's business but my own, that's a very strange concept in terms of stewardship, because I won't be here 80 years from now, a pretty good chance, unless we have incredible changes in our healthcare system. We won't be here 100 years from now, and it's not our stuff, but we've come to believe that it's mine. And I mean, even the joking t-shirts, whoever dies with the most toys wins. We talk that way, and I think it's partly driven into us by society and how the church combats that. And
maybe we need that CCC more now than we do during a depression time.
The concept of sort of a mixture of service and hard work and
right. For instance, you look at all the talent in a retired group. And if the government could set up, for example, a CCC type thing for retired people to go and restore all the national parks, you know, what a gift that'd be to the country and
finishing
tourist schools.
Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah. Boy,
you could use that. Yeah.
Yeah, and but we need a mechanism.
Well, we need a belief system.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Both.
But
without the belief system, you're not going to have it. Without the mechanism, you're not going to have it.
Yeah, but the belief system would come first, obviously. You'd have to convince somebody that, well, I look in California, we have flood after flood, and they're willing to pay, you know, to restore everything, but they aren't willing to pay young kids or something to clean out the ditches.
Right.
Before they all get cluttered with tires and shrubbery and everything. And, you know, a chit system that says, all right, we'll pay you half the money here and half the money for your college or something.
There have been both, at least in our state and at the federal level, there have been some of the National Service Corps types of things, some of which are both Elder Bush and Clinton had some initiatives like that, and Colin Powell, America Promise, whatever it is.
Right.
Those sorts of things talk about that. Whenever government issues, and again, both the previous two presidents had things like this, we're going to do it where you're going to get in exchange for the VISTA Peace Corps type of thing. You're going to get some tuition paid and other things. In the end, it becomes very frugal in small numbers of kids and no hyping it. I was going to say, when the Peace Corps came around, I sense there was a lot less competition for things like that going on, and there was the, I mean, I keep thinking the Norman Rockwell paintings of Kennedy and the young people and the new service, the new generation talking that way. That may be a part of it, because I think it's the rebuilding of community and the civic sense, the common good that I think we've lost for a variety of these reasons. But any other, I think we have about a couple more minutes. Any other comments? It's kind of, I think this is a healthy discussion, and it talked less about where the change in the government was, but I think the response to it. How do you respond to it? How do we make sure we don't do this? I think part of it is that, how do we get ourselves out of the complacency that it's times are good?
Well, I have a question about maybe how you operate within this system, having a biblical perspective and maybe a more holistic view of American citizenship. You know, how do you, as a daily worker in the system, get along?
I feel ostracized a lot of times, both the other parties and my own. I mean, I feel very frustrated, would be a good way to put it. There are victories here and there, but you feel you're pushing against the grain on things. And it's we don't want to talk about these. We don't want to talk about a lot of problems we as a society have. And I like to say that in politics, the long-term thinking is the next election. You know, this tax bill that borrowed money, $400 billion. It wasn't a direct borrow. We had capital investments in Minnesota. We pay off over 20, 30 years. We borrow money to build state universities, campus buildings, and other projects like that. We benefit for 30 years, let's pay them off over 30 years. A couple of years ago, during a surplus, we paid cash. The agreement was we paid cash for $400 million of this. It made good sense to do. I think it was 1989, 1988. We paid cash for $400 million of our projects. We still borrowed some, but the compromise was $400 paid cash. I thought that was very thoughtful. For once, instead of shuffling something off the next generation, we were paying for it now and saving them the cost later, so maybe it would help balance out some of the other things. Well, a year later, I get time to talking about a rebate, and we borrowed money and took the cash that we'd already paid for these $400 million. We took the cash, so we borrowed to pay for things we already paid for, and then we put that money into rebate. Effectively, we increased the rebate by that much because we look good in the next election then, and so on. Well, I was the only no vote in either party against that tax bill in the Senate. There are a handful in the House. But I don't go out there and saying, as a Christian, I believe this, because I don't think that's our role. I think who we are and our values and what we do is shaped by our faith and our beliefs. But it's very hard, because it's almost like as soon as people are elected, they're indoctrinated into the system. In order to get along, you go along. Compromise isn't a dirty word. And I don't think it is either. You shouldn't hesitate. If you want a full loaf of something, you can get a half loaf or three slices. It's a question, you get a good compromise. But you don't compromise your values. And they kind of gotten the two confused, compromising on policy or compromising values. So it's frustrating. And I mean, one of the reasons I like to come to Holden is to see a healthy community that's taking a look at the long-term good. What do we do to protect the infrastructure in a volunteer community? I think we all need retreat from it to take a long-term perspective, but if I could get people to look long-term, $7 in savings for every dollar we invest in chemical dependency, but we don't do it. We spend billions in crime and healthcare because we refuse to do that. 700% rate of return in a government program. I mean, people should be jumping up and down.
Yeah.
That wasn't some liberal democratic thing. It was Pete Wilson in California. They had the biggest study of the time several years ago showing that every dollar we spend as taxpayers on chemical dependency treatment saves $7 in healthcare. Incredible numbers. So anyway, I think our hour is up. I'm happy as we head up the hill to talk more, but I hope it stimulates some thinking as we go back to our communities and try to, we've got to change the political climate from one where we're what's in it for me to what can we do as a community to address these. And we don't have the Pharaoh's dream, but I'd be more inclined to believe that sometime we're going to have years of famine that we haven't addressed, and even now there are a lot of people left out. So thank you for your attendance and comments.
This is so silly.